on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
The intellectual and cultural establishment in Germany tends to shy away from anything that they call irrational. Mm. You get articles in the media saying, well, we've got to avoid anything irrational because that's redolent of the Nazis, and it's dangerous, and we have to just completely reject it. Completely reject anything occult or esoteric. Well, this is terribly sad, because they're rejecting the whole rich esoteric and mystical tradition of Germany, which goes right back to the Middle Ages, you know, and it involves great mystical thinkers like Hildegard of Bingen, Meister Eckhart, Jakob Böhme, and so on, right up to recent times.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, and humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth. I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, writer and historian Christopher McIntosh returns to Rebel Spirit Radio to discuss his latest book, Occult Germany, Old Gods, Mystics, and Magicians. Christopher explains how Germany is the fountainhead of the Western esoteric tradition and explores topics like the Dance of the Wild Man, the Holy Grail, the Rosicrucians, and the spiritual importance of gardens. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Christopher McIntosh is a British-born writer and historian who has lived in Germany for more than 30 years. He has a doctorate in history from Oxford University, a degree in German from London University, and a diploma in Russian from the United Nations Language School. He is the author of many books, including Occult Russia. He joins me today to discuss his most recent publication, Occult Germany. Christopher, welcome back to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on the show again.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to speaking with you again. It's always nice to have some returning guests and pick up conversations and explore new areas as well. And so this one is different than Occult Russia. You know, we're looking at a different area. And that's one of the first things I wanted to ask you about, because in the title, it's Occult Germany. And I think that most people would immediately think of Germany as, you know, the nation state. But you have a broader sort of definition of what you're referring to here. Yes. And I was wondering if you could maybe explain that.
Yes, well, one has to understand that Germany is, in a sense, on the one hand, a very old country, a very, very old nation, and on the other hand, a very young one. In its earlier incarnation as the Holy Roman Empire of the German nation, it goes back more than 1,000 years. But as a modern nation state, it's really only existed since 1871, when Bismarck founded the German Reich. So earlier on, it was really a collection of a loose collection of states and principalities and dukedoms and so on, loosely grouped together under the Holy Roman Empire, who for most of the time was a Habsburg monarch ruling from Vienna. So it was really more of a, Germany was really more of a cultural and ethnic and linguistic entity rather than a nation state entity. And it extended, basically it extended far beyond, as a cultural and linguistic entity, it extended far beyond the borders of what is now the Federal Republic of Germany. And even today, you have, even today, the German-speaking realm is basically the Federal Republic of Germany, Austria, German-speaking Switzerland, and there are also German communities in Belgium, Northern Italy, and elsewhere. So I treat Germany as not identical to the Federal Republic, but more as a kind of cultural and linguistic realm.
Okay. Yeah, that's really helpful. And one of the things that really impressed me when I was reading your book was how much of the esoteric traditions that we're familiar with have their grounding in that area. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of them, but you had, Agrippa, for example, part of that, Goethe, obviously, and even Rudolf Steiner. So there's this huge history to it. But before we get into many of these ideas in the books, I thought that it was really important to address the 800-pound Nazi gorilla in the room, because there's a lot of, there's a lot of YouTube videos or documentaries on Amazon about, the Nazis and occultism. And my understanding is that much of that has been sensationalized.
Oh,
So I was wondering, before we say anything else, and I think that that would be helpful for the viewers and listeners, especially those who think that that's what they're going to get is more sensationalized information about, the Nazis' use of all this symbolism. If you could speak to that a bit.
Well, in fact, the Nazi involvement with the occult was minimal, and the Nazi establishment basically had very little time for occult things, and Hitler himself repeatedly poured scorn on them. There were some exceptions. There was Heinrich Himmler, who was into the Nordic mythology and so on, and into the runes, and at his the SS castle at the Wewelsburg, he had a whole sort of quasi-pagan liturgy going with pagan weddings and pagan this and that. But that was an exception. Another exception was Rudolf Hess, who was into astrology. And it is said that it was on the basis of astrological advice that he made his famous flight to Scotland in 1941, trying to arrange a peace with Britain. But basically, the Nazis were not enthusiastic about the occult. And they were not enthusiastic about neo-pagans. I mean, you would think that the neo-pagan movement would have been welcomed by the Nazis, but in fact it wasn't, and many members of that movement were arrested, ended up in concentration camps, and so on. So it's all been much exaggerated. Of course, it's something that titillates the reading public, but yeah, it has been exaggerated out of all proportion.
Yeah, and it seems like it distracts from the history that's there, that it distracts from the pre-Christian traditions of Germany and
That's right. And it's had a very damaging effect on Germany and German culture, because the intellectual and cultural establishment in Germany tends to shy away from anything that they call irrational. You get articles in the media saying, "Well, we've got to avoid anything irrational, because that's redolent of the Nazis, and it's dangerous, and we have to just completely reject it, completely reject anything occult or esoteric." Well, this is terribly sad, because they're rejecting the whole rich esoteric and mystical tradition of Germany, which goes right back to the Middle Ages, you know, and it involves great mystical thinkers like Hildegard of Bingen, Meister Eckhart, Jakob Böhme, and so on, right up to recent times. And that's an extremely valuable tradition.
Yes. And I actually had notes about that, what you just said, that there was this push against these ideas because there's this focus on rationality and reason. And I forget who you were quoting here, but someone wrote that you quoted that it was too fresh in our minds is the memory of what happens when pure madness becomes systematic. And, you know, what occurred to me is that we're kind of undergoing something similar here in the United States, where irrationality seems to be bubbling up a little bit, which is, yeah, a little bit scary. But I was curious, and this is, I apologize, this is not part of your book. However, I wanted to ask, along this theme, that you mentioned Carl Jung a couple times. And note that, you know, he was Swiss by nationality, but his ancestry was German. He spoke and wrote in German and whatnot. And so you place him in this German tradition. And I was curious if you are familiar with his essay, Wotan.
Oh, yes, of course.
Wotan,
Yes.
Yeah.
Famous essay. Yeah.
Right. Mm. And that seems to be what the. It seems like there's a little bit of an opposite, because he argued that it was the eruption of irrationality because the pagan traditions had been suppressed and eradicated by Christianity, and that they needed to come up. But it seems like there has to be this balance, this marriage between rationality and irrationality of reason and mysticism.
Well, the Greeks knew all about that. Nietzsche writes about this. He writes about how there are two modalities, which he called the Apollonian and the Dionysiac. And Apollo represents light and reason and beauty and order, whereas Dionysus represents intoxication and passion and so on. And the Greeks realized that they had to strike a balance between these two things, because the one needs the other, you know. And his theory was that the Greeks achieved this through drama, through the classical drama. Yeah, so in a way, I think Jung is talking about the same thing. And he has a rather interesting metaphor. He says that a god is rather like a river, and over time the riverbed is dug out, but if people cease to worship that god, then the riverbed dries out, but the bed itself remains. It remains sort of in the consciousness of the people, and as soon as they reactivate the god, then the water flows back into the bed. So I think that's a very interesting essay.
Yeah. I've always been fond of that essay, and I am often thinking about, I forget, it may have been the artist, forgive me if I mispronounce, is it Dürer? There's this famous, The Sleep of Reason. The Sleep of Reason breeds monsters.
It's Goya. Goya.
Okay, that was Goya. Yes, thank you. But I always think that it's, you know, that's true. The Sleep of Reason breeds monsters. But then there's also a problem with the sleep of the irrational. If we just focus on rationality, that there has to be that sort of marriage of the two.
Yes.
And I wanted to bring this up because this is, I think, one of the themes that sort of runs through your book. Is this union of, you know, I'll use a Jungian term here, you know, almost like a Jungian union of opposites, but of nature and spirit.
Well, this is something very German, and this is in a way the central argument of my book, this bridge between spirituality and materiality. And it goes right back a long way to medieval figures like Hildegard of Bingen, who was an abbess and a Christian mystic and a theologian. But she was also a physician and a herbalist, and many of her herbal remedies she received them in visions. And her remedies are still used today. There's a whole sort of branch of alternative medicine based on her remedies. So she was an early example. And another example was, for example, the great alchemist and physician Paracelsus, who was, again, he was a religious thinker, wrote a lot about religion, but he wrote a lot about alchemy and medicine and so on. The same is true of Goethe, the poet Goethe, who was he was not only a poet, but he was a naturalist. He wrote an enormous amount about botany and nature and so on. And then a more recent example is Rudolf Steiner, who of course was greatly influenced by Goethe. And in fact, he named his headquarters in Switzerland the Goetheanum. And again, he insisted that spirituality should not be something that just floats in the ethereal realm, but it should be brought down through the hands into the material world. And so he had his biodynamic agriculture, the Waldorf schools that he founded, a form of homeopathic medicine, and the eurythmy dance method, and so on. So he was another of those people who bridged this gap between the spiritual and the material.
Yes, and I want to dig into this a little bit more, but I think maybe what we can do is take a step back, and maybe look at some of the pre-Christian traditions. And the reason I really kind of want to do this is because I think that what you wrote about is something that's happening in a lot of places where people are attempting to kind of reconstruct a spiritual religious tradition that was lost. Mm-hmm. But it has to be a reconstruction because so much is gone. So let's take this step back and look at the pre-Christian traditions that were in Germany.
Yes. Well, we don't have many written sources. The main written source we have for Germany itself is Tacitus's Germania, which I think he himself had not actually been to Germany. So he wrote it on the basis of reports of other writers, but nevertheless, it's a fairly detailed portrait of the German people. And so he tells us, for example, he describes a form of divination that they used, using pieces of wood with symbols inscribed on them, which was almost certainly the runes. So they're using runes as a means of divination. And he says various other things about them. He says he found certain things to admire about them, like that they were monogamous, and various other things. So that's the main written source. There are some other bits and pieces. There is a small piece of writing. It's called the Merseburger Zaubersprüche, the Merseburg spells, which contains basically two spells, one of which is a story about how the god Baldur's horse was cured of a broken leg using a spell, and the spell is given in the text. And then the other one is how to free oneself from chains. So these are just two tiny fragments. Then we have folk customs And there are quite a lot of those that have survived. I mean, for example, the veneration for trees. So, for example, the tradition of the Christmas tree comes out of Germany. And there's another tradition which, when a house is being built, when the timbers are in place, the roof timbers, but the roof hasn't actually been put on, that's when they put up a thing called the Richtkrone, or the Richtkranz, the topping out crown or topping out wreath, which is like a pole with a sort of wreath of pine branches around it, and sometimes arranged to look like a crown. And this you see all over the place, this Richtkrone, when a house is being built. And this, I believe this is a reference to the concept of the world tree in the Nordic mythology, the Yggdrasil, which is the world tree. And so when you put up this topping out crown, you're saying symbolically that this house is the center of my world. So that's one example. And generally the German celebration of woods and forests, I mean, German poetry and song, folk songs, are full of references to the forests and the magic of the forests and so on. So that's one aspect. Well, apart from these folk traditions, there is the Nordic mythology, which there we have the Icelandic Edda, which is, of course, fairly late, written down fairly late in history. But this gives us an idea of the ancient Nordic pantheon, the Nordic gods. And Tacitus also tells us that, for example, that they worship Mercury, who is probably the Latin variation of the god Odin. So we can to some extent reconstruct the pre-Christian, we can reconstruct some form of a pre-Christian religion.
And it seems like, if I remember correctly in your book, that it took a while for Germany to become Christianized, maybe a little bit longer than some other areas, that there was a bit of resistance to it.
Yes, that was. It was a fairly violent and bloody conversion. Most of the conversion happened around the 8th century. There was, for example, a British missionary called Bonifatius, who came to Germany to convert the German tribes. One of the things he did was that he cut down a famous tree, a famous oak tree dedicated to the god Thor, or Donar, the Donar Eiche, the Donar oak. And he cut this tree down. And this of course is hailed by Christians as a great victory in the Christianization campaign, great step forward. Whereas the neo-pagans regard it as a great sacrilege. So there's been some, you know, there's been some neo-pagan demonstrations around this. There's a in the town where this near where this oak was cut down, there's a monument to Boniface. And a group of neo-pagans wanted to put up a plaque commemorating or lamenting the cutting down of the oak. And so that was one thing that happened. There was also a famous massacre at Verden, quite near where I live, where Charlemagne's army slaughtered about 4,500, or I forget how many exactly. I think about 2,500 Saxons, pagan Saxons, as part of the Christianization campaign. And he also cut down what was called the Irminsul, the which was a sacred pillar, a pillar sacred to the Saxons. And the form of that pillar has now been adopted by modern pagans as one of their symbols. So it was a violent struggle to convert the German tribes to Christianity. And for example, Charlemagne passed a series of laws because he was concerned that people were continuing to observe the old pagan customs, like worshipping at wells, at sacred wells, and worshipping at trees and so on. So he passed a law that anyone who was caught worshipping at a sacred well or worshipping a tree would be fined. And if anyone refused to be baptized, they would be executed. But of course, it was impossible to wipe out these old practices entirely. We can see that because many of them are still being observed today.
Right. Yeah, with Christmas trees.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And I think that there's also like celebrations, and I think one you mentioned, the Dance of the Wild Man.
Yes.
And has that been, that's been going on for centuries, or is that reconstructed? Yes.
It's been going for centuries, but there was a gap. I think around the 19th century there was a gap when it wasn't being performed. And then it, relatively recently, it was revived again.
Okay.
And I've actually attended it. It's a very remarkable performance, and relates to the notion that there was a race of wild men, wild people. Who used to inhabit certain areas of Central Europe, which seems to have been the case. They do seem to have actually existed, because there are many, many references to them.
That's interesting. Now I want to know more about them. Yeah, because I think that in the description that you have of the dance, aren't they like wearing a special like clothing? Is it like supposed to represent?
Yes, they wear clothing made out of a tree bark fiber.
Okay.
So they look like enormous gorillas, or they look like pictures you see of the Yeti.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of, because here, yeah. You know, in North America, we have Sasquatch, you know, Bigfoot.
Bigfoot, yes.
So when I read this, The Dance of the Wild Man, that's what I was thinking of, was that sounds an awful lot like what we've got going on over here.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, never heard of, and I knew the Yeti, you know, Nepal and the Himalayas, but I never knew of an equivalent in Europe. So I find that quite fascinating.
Yes,
very fascinating. So we have the other thing that I thought was interesting along these same lines, and then we can move on to go a little bit deeper here. But you also noted that the witch hunts in the 15th and 17th centuries, you said that you wrote that there were more so-called witches were tortured and burned at the stake of Germany than in any other country. Now, were these people who were practicing the old pagan traditions? Do we know?
I think in some cases they may have been like wise women who were practicing herbalism and so on, looking at such midwives and so on. But basically, I think it was just hysteria. Basically, it was a kind of collective hysteria. Mm. And yes, it was very, very violent and horrible.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I know that there's also arguments that a lot of the witch hunting craze was connected to this emerging capitalism and colonialism, because they often went after women who had land.
Oh, yes, that could well be possible.
Yeah. Mm. Now, the other aspect of this pre-Christian tradition seems like that there was a shamanic aspect to it.
Yeah.
I know that Odin has some shamanic characteristics, especially the sacrifice on the Yggdrasil
Yeah,
tree.
Yggdrasil, yes. Yeah.
So I was wondering if you can maybe speak to that tradition, what we know of that tradition.
Well, yeah, I wrote about this in another book I wrote called Beyond the North Wind, about the shamanic tradition in the north. Because, well, there are different views about whether shamanism is something worldwide or whether it's confined to a particular area. But certainly, if you go around the Arctic Circle, say starting in Norway, and you go around to Den to Greenland, and then across Canada, across to Alaska, and then across to Siberia, and then back again to Scandinavia, all the indigenous peoples of that region have shamanic cultures. So it's very much something that's associated with the north, although some as I say, some people would say that it's something you find worldwide, but certainly it's very, very much connected with that whole Arctic region. In Germany itself, well, as you say, there's the legend about Odin hanging on the world tree to gain the secret of the runes, which is obviously a shamanic ordeal. And the fact that he has two ravens and two wolves, I mean, this is also very shamanic, the idea of totem animals. So those are all shamanic things. Possibly the dance of the wild men has some kind of shamanic aspect to it. I don't know, but it's something I haven't in terms of the area of Germany itself. It's something I haven't gone into a great deal.
Yeah, I know that there's a debate in scholarship about the use of the term shamanism and shaman,
Yes.
but it seems often that it's just become its own category.
Yeah.
Scholars, we love our categories, and we can identify sort of like shamanic elements. Now, whether or not there's another name that can be used, I don't know, but that's a whole other kind of conversation.
Well,
But
another shamanic element might be the topping out crown that I mentioned, that I just mentioned, because this is, as I said, I think is symbolic of the world tree, and that's another thing that you find in shamanism, the erecting of a pole. Among the Mongolian shamans, it's the tent pole, it's the central tent pole of their tents.
Yeah, that's a good point. And but there's also something of a worldview that's attributed, I think, to sort of shamanic cultures in that it's tends to be animistic. And I think a close parallel to that would be a kind of pantheism or a panentheism. And I know Meister Eckhart has been accused a little bit of being panentheistic, that God is in all
Yes.
things.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Because
Yeah.
he argued basically that the soul, the innermost soul is identical with God, which in a way is similar to the Indian
Right.
Vedantic tradition.
Right. Yeah. Atman is Brahman.
Yes.
And so I'm under the assumption that in this sort of reconstruction of the Germanic traditions and pagan traditions, that there is this kind of a shamanic aspect to it as well. Yeah. So let's move on a little bit because there's this ancient past that we don't know a whole bunch about. But I think that things get really interesting as we move on in time, especially, guess maybe it would be, well, pre-Renaissance. In terms of the time, I think one of the first people I've got here and this is definitely before the Renaissance, is the Grail legends. And
Oh,
we've got Wolfram von Eschenbach, his work Parzival. And it's always interesting because I think that the Brits, usually the Grail legends are associated with England in many ways. But Eschenbach's Parzival is earlier than a lot of the other Grail legends, I think. And the Grail.
yes, that was Parsifal was written about around 1200.
Right.
And Wolfram von Eschenbach's Parsifal is, in my view, the greatest of the Grail epics. It's a masterpiece. It's a phenomenal piece of work. And of course, that was what Wagner based his opera Parsifal on. And well, the whole thing about the Grail is something that it's a motif that crops up periodically and is reinterpreted, is seen by different in different ways in different eras. In Eschenbach, it's interesting because a lot of people think of the Grail as basically the cup of the chalice of the Last Supper, or the cup in the cup of the crucifixion. But in fact, the motif of a sacred cup goes back far into pre-Christian times. And in fact, even in Eschenbach, he writes that it is. He describes it as a pre-Christian symbol because he talks about a Moorish source from Arab Spain, which talks about how the secret of the Grail was seen in the constellations in the heavens. And that's actually very interesting in itself. And that there's the name he gives for the Grail is it's a very curious name. It's something like lapis exilis or lapsit exilis, and this has been interpreted in different ways as meaning as the Latin words lapsit ex coelis, it fell from the sky, or lapis, a stone of some kind. Anyway, it's mysterious what this name means. But there is an interesting there's an interesting fact that the area of Central Europe that is now the Czech Republic with Prague at the center is actually a natural crater which was caused by an asteroid that fell like a couple of million years ago. And the word crater is the Greek krater, which basically means a cup or a chalice. So there's one theory that this was in fact the original Grail, and there's a whole mystique attached to that territory. There's a very interesting map of Europe published around the 17th century, which shows Europe as a reclining queen, with her heart exactly where Bohemia was, with Prague at the center. So there was some mystique attached to this area, which possibly is connected with the Grail legend. But then of course you had Wagner reviving the whole mystique of the Grail in the Romantic movement. The whole Grail mystique blossomed again, and particularly in his two operas, Lohengrin and Parsifal. And this stimulated a whole sort of Grail mania, and newspapers were advertising Grail replicas that you could buy for your dining room,
Yeah, it's fascinating.
it's a perennial motif. And
Yeah.
yeah, that also connects with another interest of mine, namely King Ludwig of Bavaria, who was Wagner's patron. And King Ludwig was also fixated on the symbol of the Grail. And his famous castle, Neuschwanstein, in Bavaria, the one on which the Disneyland castle in Florida is based, in fact, his version of a Grail castle. That's the way he saw it, as his Grail castle. So the Grail, to me, it's a symbol for, shall we say, the search for perfection, the search for perfection in an imperfect world.
Yeah, and when you talk about the stone, I just mentioned very quickly two things. One, the main thing is I would think of the philosopher's stone.
Yes.
And an alchemical process, which fits in with what you just said. But it also made me think, especially when you were talking about the stone that fell from the heavens, I also was thinking about the stone that's in the Kaaba and Saudi Arabia. Very interesting.
Well, actually, Carl Jung's wife, Emma Jung, wrote a book on the Grail, and she makes the same point, actually, that she thinks the Grail was, in fact, the Philosopher's Stone, that it had something to do with alchemy.
Yeah, I've got her book right over
you
here.
Have, yes.
I've not quite read it yet. I also have Aschenbach's Parzival as well. But it makes sense to think of it in many ways in terms of this alchemical tradition, because alchemy was very active, and you said it's still active in Germany now.
Yes,
but
yes.
that whole Bohemian area was a place where alchemy sort of flourished.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Well, I mean, this is another example of this quality of bridging the spiritual and the material.
Right.
That's really what alchemy is all about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really not surprising that alchemy flourished in Germany, and
right.
it's really thanks to the German alchemical tradition that alchemy is still alive today. I mean, there was the alchemist who wrote under the name of Frater Albertus, Albert Riedel. He was a German who emigrated to the States. And he joined the Rosicrucian organization Amorc, and then he founded the Paracelsus College, which brought alchemy to a large number of people in the US.
Yeah, and the Rosicrucians, it was interesting that had its start in Germany.
That's right. Yes.
So I was wondering if maybe we could talk a little bit about the Rosicrucians, because I find them very interesting, because there's a lot of alchemical aspects too, and I think Gnostic aspects to some extent to their
Yes,
teachings.
yes. Yeah, well, the Rosicrucian movement started essentially in the early 17th century, when three so-called manifestos were published in the first one was called the Fama Fraternitatis, the declaration or proclamation or fame of the fraternity. This appeared in the Tübingen, or was written in the Tübingen area of Germany, and it appeared anonymously, and it told the story of a young German monk called Christian Rosenkreuz, who went on a journey to the Middle East. And he went first to the area which is now Syria, and went to a place called Damkar, not Damascus, but a smaller place called Damkar. And then he went along through North Africa to Fez in Morocco, and then via Spain back to Germany. And on his journey through these places, he gathered the knowledge and wisdom of the men of those regions. And on the basis of this knowledge, he then established a secret brotherhood in Germany called the Brotherhood of the Rosy Cross. Well, then after a time he died, and he was buried, and the vault in which he was buried, its whereabouts were the knowledge of its whereabouts were lost. But then sometime later, the brethren were carrying out some repairs to their headquarters, and they found this vault. And in the vault was the tomb of Christian Rosenkreutz, along with all kinds of texts and mysterious objects of one kind or another. And so that was sort of the signal for the Brotherhood to declare itself. And at the end of the Pharma Fraternitatis, there's an invitation, an open invitation to the learned of Europe to come forward and join the Brotherhood. But the trouble was that they left no mailing address, not even a 1-800 number. So nobody knew how to contact them. So what happened was that many people then published open letters saying, well, here I am, I would like to join the Brotherhood. Or other people published writings claiming to represent the Brotherhood. And other people wrote attacking the Brotherhood. And so this gave rise to a whole spate of writings and publications, which is referred to as the Rosicrucian Furor. Well, then there came a second manifesto, the Confessio Fraternitatis, Confession of the Fraternity, and a third writing called the Chemical Wedding of Christian Rosenkreutz, which was very, very different from the other two. It was a kind of symbolic sort of text written in the form of a kind of fairy tale almost. Anyway, then came the 30 Years' War, which lasted from 1618 to 1648, when Germany more or less sort of went up in smoke and the Rosicrucian Brotherhood was forgotten for a time. But meanwhile, it spread to other places. It spread to France, to Scandinavia, to Britain, and to America. Then came a revival in the 18th century with a new Rosicrucian order called the Golden and Rosy Cross. And this differed somewhat from the original movement because there was a much greater emphasis on alchemy. It emerged actually within Freemasonry, and the members were expected to have their own laboratories and work away at their furnaces and their retorts and so on. And some of them unfortunately blew themselves up in the process. But yeah, so by this time, you see, there were numerous groups all over the place calling themselves Rosicrucian, claiming the Rosicrucian heritage. And that has continued up to the present day.
Yeah, so it's still rather active then?
Oh, yes, yes, yeah. Yes. There are hundreds of groups calling themselves Rosicrucian.
Okay. Yeah, I always find them fascinating. I knew about them as a kid because my aunt was interested, and I know she wrote to get some more information. I imagine that would have been the AMARC here in the States.
Yes.
But I've known about them for quite a while, and they're always quite fascinating, quite interesting.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah, and it seems that, you know, what's happening here is there is a, you know, we've got the Renaissance is happening, and you don't mention this. I know that, well, maybe you do a little bit, because one of the things I always associate with the Renaissance is this reemergence of the Hermeticism.
Yeah.
And I would imagine that, especially in Italy, that had some effect on what was happening in Germany, that we have this rebirth and this, was there in Germany, like in Italy, I know that they looked back to their pagan traditions. Mm. Was there something similar happening in Germany at that time, in the 1600s or so, when they were looking back to their former traditions?
That's an interesting question. Yes, as you say, in Italy at that time, they would celebrate the pagan traditions. So Italian gardens, for example, are full of images of the pagan gods. There may have been something similar in Germany, but I think it came later.
Okay. Yeah.
I mean, on the subject of gardens, this is another thing that interests me. And in fact, I've written a book called Gardens of the Gods, which is about sacred and symbolic gardens in different traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very pleased to discover when I started going to Germany that Germany is extraordinarily rich in these gardens. There are some very, very remarkable examples. Like there's one particular park at Wörlitz in Saxony, built by Prince Friedrich Franz of Saxony-Anhalt, and it's built around a series of lakes and waterways projecting out from the river Elbe, and it's laid out in the form of an initiatory itinerary, and there's a very interesting description by the man who planned the whole thing, who was very well versed in classical mythology and so on. So he takes you on a tour through the garden and explains the significance of each item. So there's a sort of rocky enclosure where you stop for meditation, and then you go on and you go underneath a hill where there are four grottos corresponding to the four elements, fire, earth, air, and water. And at the point where you emerge, there was going to be an aeolian harp, where you would hear the harp for the air element, and so on. So it's quite a remarkable place. And there are a number of other gardens and parks of this sort. So in those you will see images of the pagan gods, but that was more in the 18th century.
Okay, yeah, which I would associate with, well, the kind of the 19th century, late 18th century, 19th century, as sort of romanticism.
Romanticism, yes, exactly.
Yeah, which is in a way maybe another way of thinking about it's another kind of Renaissance, perhaps. Because after I asked you the initial question about whether, you know, Germans were looking back to their pagan traditions, what came to my mind is like, well, no, of course they're not going to, because you've got the Protestant Reformation has been in full swing at that point, especially after the 30 Years' War. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I always see a connection between what was going on with the Protestant Reformation with the colonies here in the United States. I've often said that the Protestant Reformation really reached its apex here in the United States. But anyway, yeah, and I can't imagine the Puritans, my ancestor Puritans, looking to any kind of pagan gods at all. You know, but nature was something that was, And at that point, nature for them was something that was seen as not very good. It was the abode of dark forces in many ways. But I don't think that that was something that probably happened in Germany, because there had been this love of the land and of gardens and of forests and trees.
Yes, yes. And within Protestant Germany, there was, well, I think maybe to even some extent in Catholic Germany as well, but there was a movement of, there was a whole literary movement called nature philosophy, Naturphilosophie. And this was also connected with alchemy.
Mm.
And for example, there was a school of poets who were using alchemical imagery a lot. For example, treating the three alchemical principles of salt, sulfur, and mercury as corresponding to the Trinity, that kind of thing. And talking about God as the great smelter and this kind of thing. I mean, it's very interesting how many of these mystical thinkers were also had a foot in very, very down-to-earth activities. Like one example would be the poet Novalis. Novalis was the name he wrote under. His real name was Friedrich von Hardenberg. I think it was Friedrich von Hardenberg. And he was a poet, a mystic, wrote lots of mystical religious stuff. But he was also a mining engineer, and he wrote a treatise on chemistry. But this was very typical. This is something very German, you know, this combination of the spiritual and the material.
Yeah. Because I think one of the things that we struggle with worldwide, maybe that's unfair, but I think worldwide, and this is kind of where you go at the sort of towards the end of the book, but you mentioned it before that there has been this focusing on a division between the material and the spiritual, and we've put many people put their emphasis on the spiritual of a kind of transcending the world. But it seems that what is so crucial in our present moment is to return the spirit to the material.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, this is very, very much what I'm into personally. I mean, one way I'm trying to do it is through gardening and horticulture.
Yeah, you wrote about your garden in the book, kind of going back to the gardens that you
yeah
did something
yeah I did
about.
A bit, yes,
Yeah.
yes.
Yeah, that was very interesting that you kind of like rounded the corners, if I remember right, and I forget what else you did, but
oh yes. Well, that was it. At our previous house, where the garden was basically just a long rectangle, so the energy just sort of went whoosh through it, straight through it. So we rounded the beds on either side, so the energy sort of undulated through it instead of just going through in a straight line, and created a certain symbolic scheme of revolving around the sun and the moon and so on. Yeah, and then we've done something, well, a bit different here at our present house, because it's a different layout. It's that the house is in the middle and the garden runs all around it.
Oh, okay.
So it forms a kind of natural itinerary. So you go around.
Okay.
You go around it.
Now, and that the garden at your former house, I'm curious, what were you growing? Were you growing flowers, vegetables, and
flowers?
Okay.
Well, there were already some trees there, some nice mature trees.
Okay. All right.
So,
yeah, because I was
we had
curious whether
all
or
kinds
not,
of.
no, I'm sorry. I was curious if, because the reason I wanted to know if it was vegetables, I was just kind of curious if you noticed an improvement in growth.
No. No, we haven't. Yes, I know that other people have experienced that
Okay.
improvement in growth. The flowers seem to grow very well. The flowers that we grew.
Okay. Yeah, very fascinating. I like the idea of the house being surrounded by the garden. Yeah, a moat of flowers, I suppose. Yeah. So I want to talk a little bit about the present moment, but before we get there, I know that you've mentioned Wagner, and I think that maybe it would be important to speak a little bit more towards Wagner, because I think Wagner is someone who is known, at least the name is known worldwide. And at some point you noted in the book that his operas became like a ritual themselves.
Yes. Yes, he saw them as basically almost religious rituals. And he, in fact, he wanted the opera Parsifal only to be performed at the Bayreuth Festival Theatre, which was purpose-built for him. But all his later operas have that same quality, the same ritual quality. And well, I was quite young when I first came into contact with, and I was just completely blown away by his music. It just blew me into outer space. That was really how I came to King Ludwig, because having become fascinated by Wagner, I then became fascinated by Ludwig, who was his great patron. Yeah, so one thing he did was to bring the Nordic mythology, or to revitalize the Nordic mythology. And yeah, that was one of the things that helped to create the pagan revival in the late 19th century, early 20th century. The relationship, the German relationship to Wagner is today is somewhat ambivalent, because we know that the Nazis admired Wagner. Same time, I mean, his music is so sublime and so powerful that it's impossible to ignore him. So there is today, Wagner has a very strong following in Germany today. And the Bayreuth Opera House, the Bayreuth Festival Theatre, is always booked out every year for the Bayreuth Festival. Yeah, so he's a key figure in German cultural history.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because you've got this romanticism before World War II, and then after World War II, it seems like it was almost used as a little bit of a scapegoat in a sense that, oh, we were kind of being irrational, and now we just can't have any of that. But one of the interesting things, and I don't know if this is part of the romantic movement there, but I know that one of the sources, one of the things that has often been accused of giving birth to the Nazis was this Völkisch movement or the Völkisch tradition. But I know that you also wrote that, and others have as well, that the National Socialist largely rejected this Volkish stuff. So, am I right in thinking of the Volk? I don't know what how to word this as a kind of looking back to the pre-Christian traditions and rooting themselves in nature and in the land.
That was part of it, yes. Mean, a typical example of a folkish figure was Fidors, the artist Fidors, whom I write about in the book, who was he was an interesting sort of mixture, because he was in a way a kind of hippie, a kind of an avant-garde artist with a kind of a hippie lifestyle. But at the same time, he was a neo-pagan, wanted to found a sort of new nature-centered, earth-centered religion, wanted to build a temple. And I showed in the book his drawing, the way he imagined this temple of the earth, as he called it. And but he was involved in the Monte Verita colony, which I also mentioned in the book, which was actually located in Switzerland, but it was a lot of Germans went there. And that was a kind of early hippie colony, you could say. So he was involved in that. But then later on, he became involved in well, he became an admirer of the Nazis, and he placed great hopes in the Nazis. But they wanted nothing to do with him, and completely rejected his art. And I think in the end he was forbidden to exhibit his works. So he was a typical example of one of the folkish people who were very disappointed by the Third Reich and were very much looked down upon and often persecuted.
Okay. You know, one of the things that I think is important is this grounding of, again, to the land. And I think that this is where one of the reasons that the Volkisch movement is connected to the Nazis is in this idea of blood and soil.
Yeah, yes.
You know, and this was something that was brought to my attention in some of the work that I've been doing when I was going through my doctoral program, because I was trying to do something else similar. It's like, you know, we need to ground our spirituality and our being into the land. And my dissertation advisor, she's like, okay, awesome. But how do you avoid blood and soil? So that's a question for you, because I think it's important that we reconnect to the land, but how, and I hope this isn't an unfair question, but in what ways can we avoid the negative aspect of that?
Well, we shouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
So we don't need to use a term like blood and soil.
Right.
Well, why not just soil? You know,
right.
We don't need to,
yeah.
we don't need to say blood and soil.
Right. Yeah. Spirit and earth, maybe.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of what I'm trying to do here.
Right.
You know,
Right.
With our garden.
Yeah. More people need to. And I always have this sense that, and maybe this is you know, I hope it's not a stereotype. If it is, I don't think it's a negative stereotype, but I see way more concern about the state of the Earth's environment and with climate change coming from places like Germany, that in Europe, that they take it way more seriously than, you know, we Americans do in general.
I think that's true, yes.
Yeah. And so what is the state now of, because I remember in the book that, you know, after World War II, there was this focus on rationality that we kind of talked about. And yet things started bubbling up a little bit, like, you know, the New Age movement and this neo-paganism. Where are the Germans now in terms of this esoteric occult traditions that is part of their heritage? How is it flowering now?
Well, there's quite a big popular interest in the esoteric and occultism. There are new age bookshops, you know, where you can buy books on, I don't know, yoga and crystal gazing and flying saucers and all of that. But among the cultural, among the majority of the cultural establishment, I would say there's still a suspicion towards these things. And the thing is that the Third Reich really created a gap, a lacuna in the collective memory, in Germany's collective memory, its cultural history. I became aware of that when I was teaching English at the University of Bremen. And I remember in one class, I got onto the subject of the Holy Grail. And I asked the students if they knew what that was. And only one young man raised his hand, and he said, "Oh, yes, I believe it has something to do with eternal life and rejuvenation and stuff like that." And that was all he knew. And the others didn't have a clue. So I thought that was very sad, because to me that the Holy Grail is one of those universal references. I mean, when I was growing up, it was one of those references that I was very much aware of. It was part of the air that I breathe. It was part of our cultural memory, but they just didn't have a clue. But this is an example of how the cultural memory of Germany has been interrupted by the Third Reich. And one of the things that I hope my book will do is to give them a renewed appreciation of this cultural heritage, this right. tremendously rich heritage that they have.
Yeah. I wonder if that is something that's unique to Germany in a sense, because I'm putting myself in some of my classrooms.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm wondering if I were to ask students, well, what's the Holy Grail? Or how many of you have heard of it? I don't know how many of them would say that they did, that they knew about it.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I mean, they may have a sense from, I don't know, like Indiana Jones or something. But yeah, it's always interesting. I remember this is a little bit off topic, but in a sense, it's not, because it's, again, connected to nature in many ways. But I remember several years ago, I was teaching a summer class, and I had noted that the next day was going to be the summer solstice. And
oh, yeah.
a student's like, well, what's that?
Oh, they
And
didn't know.
No, they did not know. But and what was shocking is I'm like, well, and I probably should have explained it another way. I'm like, well, it's the longest day of the year. And the student's response was, so it's like 25 or 26 hours.
Good Lord.
Yeah, I'm like, no. But that showed me that there is this disconnect of, you know, with the cycles of nature and the seasons and whatnot. And so that's why that was coming into my mind when you were talking about the students who were unfamiliar with the Holy Grail.
Yeah, maybe it's not just a German problem.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe it is, but I don't know. It's interesting where, you know, how much we've forgotten of our cultures, I think.
Yeah.
You know, and what's preserved and what isn't.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think, do you see it, though, becoming more prominent, this kind of looking back? And especially, this is why I mentioned like the environmental movements and whatnot. It seems like there's a connection to environmentalism and the spiritual aspect to it. Do you see that becoming more dominant or predominant or growing? I don't know how to ask the question. Do you see that happening in Germany now?
Yeah, I think slowly. I mean, one can see that in the growth of the neo-pagan movement, and a movement like Wicca, the neo-witchcraft movement. It's growing very slowly, but it is growing.
Yeah, isn't there a German version of that that's not Wicca per se? Is it Astru or something?
Also true, yes. That's the Nordic paganism.
Okay. And has that, I don't know, I know you mentioned that in the book. You don't go into a lot of details of it. I know that Wicca was a kind of a recreation by folks like Gerald Gardner. Is
yes,
the
yes.
Asatru, is that similar? Did it emerge
Well,
out of?
Well, Asatru, the word Asatru is of relatively recent origin.
Okay.
It came out of Iceland. A close friend of mine is head of the Asatru community in Iceland, Hilmar Hilmarsson. And he joined the movement when it was at a very early stage. It was basically founded around 1973 by an Icelandic poet called Svenbjørn Bjørnteinsen, and they and a group of friends, and they looked around for a term to call the movement, and they came across the term Azatru, which was being used in Denmark, and it was in the Icelandic constitution that if you wanted to, if you wanted to have a religious community, that I forget now why they chose the term Azatru, but it was already in use in Denmark, and so they called it Azatru, and this was then taken up in other countries, including the US. So it's a term that is now very widely used for the Germanic paganism, Nordic Germanic neo-paganism.
Yeah, I see elements of it here where, and it's fairly new, but I see something similar where people are looking back. In the US, a lot of it is onto the Celtic traditions. But I do see elements of the Germanic tradition coming up quite a bit. Because a lot of us have German heritage. Well, I found your book very interesting. I learned a lot. I learned a lot. And even though we've gone into several different areas, we just kind of skimmed the surface of what's in your book. So I think it's something that is can be very helpful to people. It's I think it's an important history. And like I said, I was really, what hit me was how much, and I said this at the very beginning of our conversation, how much of the Western esoteric traditions are grounded in Germany. And a lot of it, I'm like, oh, well, yeah, that makes total sense. I mean, this is, you know, why didn't I think of that before?
Yes, it's really the fountainhead of so many aspects of the Western esoteric tradition, including Rosicrucianism and alchemy and homeopathic medicine, which came out of the alchemical tradition. All of these things.
I know we're kind of running out of time, but one of the questions I wanted to ask you, because you address this very briefly in the book, but that in scholarship, there has been, scholarship has not been very friendly. I don't want to say that they've been, that there's been any kind of animosity, but in terms of studying esoteric traditions, I know that that has not been part of what academics looked at, but that's changing. And it's changing here in the US, I know, to some extent. And to what extent is that changing in Germany and Europe in general?
Well, in Germany, rather slowly, but it is changing. It is changing. I mean, I've observed this whole process from a very, very early stage, because I started writing about these things back in the 1960s. My first book was a book on astrology, which I published in 1969. And when I was writing that, there was almost nobody in academia who was writing about these things. There were some serious scholars outside academia, but within the academy, very few. One of them was Frances Yates at the Warburg Institute, and she was really a pioneer of these studies, because she was, back in the 1960s, she was writing books about the Hermetic tradition. And there was one other place where these things were being studied, which was the Sorbonne, the École Pratique des Hautes Études at the Sorbonne. But then gradually, more and more people started to write about these things. And then you had the foundation of a chair at Amsterdam University, which is now, my friend Wouter Hennegraaff is now the head of that department. And so, and gradually young scholars came into this field. and got positions at universities. And now that there are a number of these who now have positions in Germany, some of them are friends of mine. So it's very encouraging.
Yeah. And I am a fan of, I think this is in Prague, perhaps, the Rotman Library.
That's Amsterdam. The Rotman
Amsterdam,
Library.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah, that's on my wish list of places I would like to go and just be for a while.
Oh, yes, it's a great, wonderful place.
Yeah. But it seems to be part of this that, you know, the literature, you know, to have a place where the literature is preserved.
Yes.
That we didn't have before. So, Christopher, I know we are kind of at the end here. We've been chatting for quite a while, but let me ask you my final questions. One is, what are you working on next? And the second part of that is, where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, what's in the pipeline is a book, is a sort of a spiritual autobiography, which I have actually finished, and it's with the publisher and going through the process of publication. And well, people can go to my website. I'll give you the address. That is www.osgard.net.
Okay.
Osgard.net. It's Oz as in the Wizard of Oz, combined
yes.
with Guard as in garden, Osgard.
Okay. All right. Very good. www.osgard.net. I will put a link for that in the show notes and video description, plus links for your latest book, Occult Germany, which
you.
If anyone has any interest in this, it's well worth reading. It's a treasure house of information, I think. And like I said, we've only touched the surface on some of the things that you write about in the text. So, Christopher, thank you again for coming onto the show. I really appreciated the opportunity to reconnect with you, because I remember I really liked Occult Russia too. And I've referred to that several times, actually. So you've been a teacher for me, which I appreciate.
Thank you. Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
And that's a wrap on episode 138 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. Now, you know what's coming up next. All the usual. Sign up for my Patreon, share this with friends and family, coworkers, and on social media. Subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. You know the grind. But here's the thing. All that is really important. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I'm in the process of making changes to improve the podcast and the YouTube channel. It's slow going, but your support will help me speed up the process and ensure that I can continue with the podcast and offer much more content than what I do now. As I always like to say, I'm here in the front range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, psychedelics and consciousness, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's relationship with the sacred earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and you know I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to, or watching, Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.